The wind picks up, carrying particles that darken the sky until the sun shows red through it. A great dust storm descends, blanketing everything in its path. Men stand silent by their fences, watching their dust-covered corn wither. Women watch the men anxiously, knowing they'll endure as long as the men's resolve holds. This environmental catastrophe transforms not just the land, but an entire economic system. Tenant farmers who worked these acres for generations suddenly find themselves displaced by tractors and banks. The owners speak coldly. A bank or a company can't breathe air, they breathe profits. When families protest that their grandfathers killed Indians for this land, that they themselves bled here, the owners remain unmoved. The bank is something more than men, it's the monster. Behind the tractors come discs and harrows, slicing the earth methodically, without passion. The connection between man and earth is severed as the land gradually dies under iron because it was not loved or hated, it had no prayers or curses. Tom Joad returns from prison to find his family home abandoned, the door swinging open in the wind. Along the way, he encounters Jim Casey, a former preacher who baptized him years ago. Casey explains his spiritual crisis and new philosophy that perhaps all men share one big soul. When Tom finally reunites with his family, the emotional anchor is Ma Joad, a woman who has mounted pain and suffering like steps into a high calm. She confides her fear that prison might have made Tom poisoned mad, like Pretty Boy Floyd, whom she knew as a good boy before being hunted like a coyote. The family prepares for their westward journey with methodical precision, slaughtering pigs, carefully selecting kitchen items, burning treasured possessions that can't be carried. Highway 66 becomes their lifeline, the mother road, the road of flight, stretching from Mississippi to Bakersfield. The migrants stream along in old jalopies, fearing breakdowns and counting miles on bald tires. When they finally reach the summit overlooking California's valley, the Joads are awestruck. Ruthie whispers, "It's California," while Winfield simply says, "There's fruit." But the promised land quickly reveals itself as a place of exploitation. Land ownership is transformed from a passionate connection to earth into a cold business where crops were reckoned in dollars and love was thinned with money. Californians despise the newcomers. Owners fear their strength, storekeepers scorn their poverty, laborers resent the wage competition. The migrants are labeled Okies, a term that stuns Ma when she first hears it. Labor contractors flood the state with handbills, then offer lower wages when too many desperate workers arrive. The Joads move from one disappointment to another, from a squalid Hooverville to working as strikebreakers picking peaches for 5 cents a box. The family finds temporary relief at the government camp at Weed Patch. Directed by a night watchman to Number 4 Sanitary Unit, Tom discovers the camp's remarkable self-governance through an elected central committee that establishes its own rules. Various subcommittees, including the Women's Committee, organize childcare and maintain facilities. The regular Saturday night dances represent the dignity these families had lost during their journey. Ma's experience in the washrooms is transformative. Initially confused by the modern facilities, she accidentally enters the men's washroom, where an elderly resident kindly redirects her without mockery. The warm, clean water washes away not just dirt, but shame. Eventually, economic necessity forces the Joads to leave Weed Patch for cotton fields, where they live in boxcars converted into makeshift homes. Tom undergoes a profound transformation after witnessing Jim Casey's murder during a labor dispute. After killing the man responsible, Tom hides in blackberry bushes where he shares a pivotal conversation with Ma about Casey's teaching that isolation means spiritual death. Tom embraces a larger purpose. "I'll be all around in the dark. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready." This transformation embodies the novel's central evolution from personal survival to collective action. The shift from "I lost my land" to "We lost our land" represents a revolutionary awakening. As Steinbeck writes, the quality of owning freezes you forever into I and cuts you off forever from the we, suggesting possession creates isolation while shared struggle fosters unity. Despite desperate circumstances, migrants create beauty through storytelling and music, with harmonicas and guitars passed through generations. Relentless rain brings new suffering. The parched earth absorbs moisture until saturated, forming lakes across fields. Migrant families build small dikes around their shelters, but persistent downpour soaks everything. When flooding becomes unbearable, they try to leave, but water-fouled ignition systems prevent cars from starting. Terror spreads with news of no work for 3 months. Food disappears, and children cry with hunger. Sickness follows, pneumonia and measles that attack eyes and mastoids. Men in sodden clothes wade to towns begging for food, hopeless anger smoldering beneath their cringing. The Jodes boxcar floods, forcing them to pile possessions on a makeshift platform with pregnant Rose of Sharon at the top. They share their last 10 potatoes over a struggling fire as water rises. When the boxcar becomes uninhabitable, the family wades to higher ground, carrying Rose of Sharon, who feels kinda dizzy after delivering a stillborn child. They find shelter in a barn with a starving man and his young son. The boy explains his father hasn't eaten for 6 days, first claiming he wasn't hungry, then becoming too weak. In the novel's final scene, Ma exchanges a profound look with Rose of Sharon, who whispers, "Yes." After Ma leads everyone else away, Rose of Sharon lies beside the dying man. When he weakly shakes his head, she bares her breast and draws his head to it, saying simply, "You got to." Supporting his head, she smiles mysteriously. This tableau, at once maternal, erotic, and deeply human, embodies the novel's message about survival through connection and sacrifice. In temporary highway encampments, 20 separate families become one extended family. Their losses merge into collective loss. Their dreams of California become shared dreams. A sick child concerns everyone. A birth brings joy to all. Even those with little search for gifts for newborns. After rain, men examine flooded land, while women observe fear transforming into anger, a relief, as the break won't come as long as fear can become wrath. This cycle of devastation and renewal, exploitation and resistance, forms Steinbeck's enduring vision. In an era of climate migration, inequality, and labor activism, The Grapes of Wrath reminds us that our humanity depends on how we treat those with the least power. The final message celebrates finding grace in shared vulnerability and strength in our connections to one another.